Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It is Thursday, April 4th, 2013. Our top two stories today come from Alabama. For over 5 years on this program and its predecessor, we have been providing exhaustive coverage of the persecution and legal prosecution of former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman. Karl Rove and his buddies railroaded Siegelman into prison around phony charges that a man named Richard Scrushy bribed him. The claim was that Scrushy gave $500,000. To a committee run by Siegelman that had promoted an initiative for a lottery to benefit education in Alabama. And ultimately, both men were convicted. Today, Richard Scrushy broke his silence in his first interview since he was released from prison last summer. Scrushy responded to wide-ranging questions from me and Roger Shuler, the dedicated blogger at the Legal Schnauzer blog, who has provided excellent coverage of these issues from the ground in Alabama. And because I think this interview is so important, we're not going to restrict it at all to subscribers. It's released and available to everyone today at peterbcollins.com. And Scrushy makes some very important statements, offers new dimensions, and breaks some ground on the details of this misguided effort. And Scrushy is remarkably not that angry. He doesn't seem to want to get even, but he wants to clear his name, and he wants to see Don Siegelman released from prison as soon as possible. In this excerpt from our in-depth interview, I asked Mr. Scrushy, who was the real target here? Was it him? Was it Siegelman? Or, well, you listen. Richard Scrushy, were you the main target of these sequential prosecutions? And was Siegelman just a way to get to you? Or was this a twofer for Karl Rove in the prosecution in Montgomery that led to your dual convictions?
Well, that's a very good question. It probably was a twofer. I think they wanted, there's no doubt Karl Rove wanted the governor. And I do believe that, you know, I could have, if I had been willing to get up and do what they asked me to do and say the things that they wanted me to say, that I would have walked out. And I wouldn't have gone to prison. And I wouldn't have done the time. But I'm just not that kind of man, Peter. I'm not going to get up and lie on him. I didn't know Governor Siegelman that well. But I could not get up and say the things that they asked me to say because they were not true, and then know that he's got two children and a wife, and the rest of my life, I've got to get up every day and look in the mirror and say, Richard Scrushy, you're nothing but a liar, and you know you put that man in prison. I'm not going to do that. I'd rather go spend the 5 or 6 years in prison myself, and that may be hard for people to understand, but that's just who I am. And my wife and my kids suffered greatly. I mean, 5 years, 6 years of my life away from my wife and kids, it was horrible. And it was in a horrible place, and a place no man ever wants to go. But I feel better about myself because I don't have to worry about the fact that these other people put this man in prison, and he shouldn't be in prison today. He is innocent. He did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. There was no corruption. There was no bribery. There was nothing. This thing is a total farce, total fraud. And maybe they got a twofer to answer your question. I don't know if that's what he wanted or not, but he certainly got Governor Siegelman and he got me.
Richard Scrushy gives us important details that show how fabricated the prosecution case was and how Nick Bailey, the star witness, clearly lied because the details about the check that allegedly was the fundamental issue in this alleged bribery scheme, the amount of the check was off by half. The claim was that it was $500,000. It was only $250,000. Don Siegelman never personally met with Richard Scrushy, either to solicit the contribution or to request that he rejoin a state health care board that was unpaid volunteer. So the idea that there was a quid pro quo is simply not supported by the evidence. And at one point, Scrushy admits that he really regrets that he didn't take the witness stand. They believe that the prosecution case was so weak that they didn't need to. And so it's quite a story as we continue to unravel this saga in Alabama. And Don Siegelman remains in federal prison, has another 5 years plus to go. I hope you'll listen and share that interview widely with friends. Put it up on Facebook, pass it around to people. It's a very important case, and we need to fix the justice system that has sent two men to prison for a crime that didn't exist and that they didn't commit. Meanwhile, in Alabama, abortion is becoming more and more difficult to obtain. And this is a concerted effort by right-wing Christians and their representatives in state government. The State House of Representatives voted 68-21, and they call this the Women's Health and Safety Act. The Senate approved it on a 20-10 vote. So it goes to the governor, and Robert Bentley, a Republican, says he'll sign it. And this law mirrors one in Mississippi and one in North Dakota that tries to create standards that abortion clinics cannot meet or are unable to meet, and therefore they won't be able to operate. And it's a direct challenge to the federal Roe versus Wade court ruling that established a right to choice, a right to abortion access in this country. And what we're seeing is that a woman's right to access abortion safely is being washed away, nibbled away. And ultimately, this will lead to a challenge, they hope, at the U.S. Supreme Court, and they're hoping that the court will be packed in a way that overturns Roe versus Wade. The Alabama bill says that any doctor who performs an abortion has to have admitting privileges at a hospital in the same city. So far, there are no doctors who meet that requirement in Alabama or nearby states who perform abortions. The bill also sets a stricter requirement for the physical facilities so that abortion clinics either have to spend a lot of money to remodel or shut their doors. Silly stuff, wider halls, bigger doors, better fire suppression systems. These are bogus impediments to a woman's access to abortion. Also under the bill, abortion clinics are required to ask any girl under age 16 the name and age of the person who got her pregnant. She doesn't have to answer if she's over 16. But if she does answer and the father is more than 2 years older, then the clinic is required to report that to police for investigation of a possible sex crime. If the girl is under 14, the clinic must report her name to the State Department of Human Resources for review. Now, they claim that they're trying to protect young women. But the bottom line is, they are intentionally using these bogus new regulations to prevent access to abortion. And Alabama already has one of the strictest laws in the country. You can't get an abortion later than 20 weeks in pregnancy. And that is an issue that will have to be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court as well. President Obama stopped traffic in San Francisco yesterday. Air Force One came into SFO. He motorcaded into the ritzy part of town, the area with views of the Golden Gate Bridge. He later helicoptered out of the area, which spared traffic jams. But he was confronted, as I mentioned yesterday, by both inside and outside opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. The insiders, led by Tom Steyer, a billionaire who hosted a fundraiser at their home in the Seacliff area of San Francisco. About 100 guests were there. And it's not clear if Tom Steyer directly stated his opposition in the presence of President Obama. But both know where each other stands. And as the president raided the California ATM for $3.2 million, not for his campaign account, he doesn't need to run anymore, but for House Democrats, he extolled the leadership of Nancy Pelosi and how he could get more done if she were the Speaker of the House. And without explicitly taking a position on Keystone XL, the president clearly indicated that he's leaning toward approving it, because he talked about the tough politics of the environment. Last month, 17 Democratic senators signed on to an amendment backing construction of Keystone XL. And at Steyer's home, the president is quoted as saying, "Despite a very aggressive agenda on the other side to block action, we've been able to double fuel efficiency standards on cars. We've been able to take mercury out of our air. We've been able to reduce carbon emissions in this country." Then when he went to the home of the billionaire oil heir, the descendants of John Paul Getty, the president said the political debate needs to break out of this notion that somehow there's a contradiction between us being good stewards of the environment and us growing this economy. They are not a contradiction. We can grow this economy fast and faster if we're seizing the opportunities of the future and not just looking at the energy sources of the past. Well, that sounds good, but in talking about the non-contradiction, the president really put himself squarely into the contradiction that he knows Keystone XL is not a good deal. It won't really create that many jobs. The crude oil from tar sands in Canada that flows through it will be refined in Texas and most likely shipped offshore, so it doesn't help us with energy independence. And the current oil pipeline spill in Arkansas is a grim and very current reminder that pipelines leak and that tar sands are the worst of the crude products that at least I'm aware of. They're having a hell of a time cleaning up in Arkansas. And Steve Horn, the great young reporter at DSmog Blog, has two important stories related to pipelines. One is that in Arkansas, ExxonMobil, which is responsible for this oil spill in Mayflower, has basically imposed a no-fly zone. Well, actually, the FAA did it, the Federal Aviation Administration. But the no-fly zone is being overseen by ExxonMobil in the form of a guy named Tom Surhoff, who has been empowered by the FAA to say who can fly over it and who can't. He works for ExxonMobil as an aviation advisor, formerly a U.S. Army pilot for 24 years. And just as BP fudged the reports, underaccounted for how much oil was spewing out of the Deepwater Horizon's spill in the Gulf, ExxonMobil is trying to control media coverage, limit the access. Already, we're seeing wide disparities in the early estimates of just how much of this tar sands crude spilled. And the estimates that I heard on television news on Wednesday night were about five times greater than what we had been told the day before. Also, Steve Horn reports, and I'm going to link to both of these stories in the show file with this podcast at peterbcollins.com. The contractor who wrote the report for the State Department that says that the Keystone XL pipeline is a safe and sound project previously wrote a similarly rosy approval for the expansion of a natural gas project in Peru that has since racked up a disastrous track record. You can read this article for yourself, but the group, the Environmental Resources Management Group, has historical ties to Big Tobacco, published a study declaring safe a Caspian Sea pipeline that ended up spilling 70,000 barrels of oil. And we have Bradley Manning to thank for that information. And their client list includes Koch Industries, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. So they are hardly an independent group, and yet they had a pipeline spokesman on the PBS NewsHour last night, a very slick guy. I guess he has tar sands with his breakfast cereal. And he was busy saying that, these pipelines haven't failed because of what is flowing through them. It is external corrosion. But the other talking head who appeared opposite him from the Natural Resources Defense Council scored many points by pointing out that because the bitumen in tar sands requires a higher temperature to remain a liquid, that these pipelines are hot. It's not just room temperature, not just ground temperature. They operate at elevated temperatures all the time. And this produces corrosion. With the exposure to weather, you can imagine that the hot and cold, the expansion and contraction, leads to problems at seams, junctions, and valve insertions. So, President Obama is trying to sweet talk the people who just put $3 or $4 million into campaign accounts for Democrats, talking about just how tough it is, and then spinning up the other accomplishments. Sure, I'm glad to see the EPA mileage requirements have been lifted, elevated. But that doesn't address tar sands. It doesn't really address the fact that this is a decision that is squarely in the hands of the president. And that's why Bill McKibben and others have made it such a big issue. It's not the defining environmental matter of our time. It's a tipping point. And the president wants to use his sweet talk to distract us from that very reality. In the New York Times on April 2nd, there was an important editorial responding to remarks that were made not too long ago by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court. And of course, the issue was not specifically marriage equality, because that's before the court, and she, of course, wouldn't comment on that in public. No justice who observes the rules would do so. But in comments that are linked to the concern that she expressed from the bench in the oral arguments about moving too quickly on same-sex marriage, she talked about the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that I referred to about the Alabama abortion rules just a moment ago. And she said that Roe moved too far, too fast. And the Times, in a detailed rejoinder, does a good job of refuting her comment, pointing out that back in that day, that the state-level decriminalization of abortion had stalled out, mostly due to opposition from the Catholic Church. For example, Nelson Rockefeller, who was known as a very liberal Republican governor of New York, in 1970 vetoed a measure legalizing abortion in the Empire State. And so, without Roe v. Wade, maybe a handful of states would have legalized abortion and made access reasonably available. But we wouldn't have had a standard nationally that has been chipped away at recently at the state level. And likewise with same-sex marriage, the issues of setting a national policy have to do with equal rights. It's that simple. You can't discriminate against same-sex couples who are married because they happen to live in one of the 9 states that has legalized it. You can't use federal law to discriminate against people who have legally followed state law. And while I know the court's signals from the oral arguments don't indicate that a sweeping decision is likely, that's what is called for. That's what we need to really square away this situation and the unequal protection that same-sex couples suffer these days. There's been an exchange of rockets and airstrikes between the Palestinians in Gaza and Israel's military forces. This is in reaction to the death of a Palestinian who was held in a prison in Israel, Maisara Abu Hamdia, age 64, got a diagnosis of throat cancer 2 months ago, and died on Tuesday in an Israeli hospital. This has led to protests and 2 separate rounds of rocket fire from Gaza into Israel, causing no damage and injuring no people. And it does violate a ceasefire that was brokered by Egypt last fall. And so Israel responded by sending jet fighters over the Gaza Strip, and these were really warning shots. They dropped a couple of bombs in open fields in the north end of Gaza. No damage or casualties reported. But this heightening of tensions and Israel's treatment of Palestinian prisoners are still very clearly a problem. Google is doing the right thing. They're, of course, recovering from the backlash from Christians who were upset that on Easter Sunday, instead of the Easter Bunny or the risen Christ, Google chose to acknowledge Cesar Chavez because it was his birthday, and that's a state holiday here in California. Now they're fighting a good fight against the creeping expansion of the police state and the muscular national security letters that are enabled by the Patriot Act. Google has gone to court before federal judge Susan Eielston here in San Francisco. And while they have to operate under laborious secrecy regulations, they're basically saying, we want the court to block the FBI from requiring Google to give up information on its users to the FBI and not notify those users. And this is on the heels of a recent ruling from Judge Eielston regarding NSLs in a suit brought by the great folks at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They're the ACLU for electronic communications. EFF had challenged the constitutionality of the part of federal law that imposes non-disclosure requirements and limits judicial review of national security letters. Eielston ruled that the NSL requirements violate the First Amendment and separation of powers principles and barred the FBI from invoking that language in this or any other case. And that's what caused Google to go to court. They've effectively put the FBI on notice, saying their interpretation of the law means that agents may not use an NSL to obtain anything else from Google, such as Gmail content, search queries, YouTube videos, or user IP addresses. And this is built on the case that came from Nick Merrill. And Sibel Edmonds and I interviewed him in a Boiling Frogs interview a couple of years ago. He is a New York internet service provider who got an NSL and managed to challenge the gag order part of it as unconstitutional. He didn't win the case, but they ultimately just dissolved the national security letter rather than press the point and set a bad precedent. So I hope Google wins this one. Yesterday, we reported that boneheads in the legislature in North Carolina had proposed a law that would establish a state religion. Smarter heads have prevailed, The bill was killed in committee. Praise the Lord. Late night television is being shaken up, at least in some homes, as Jay Leno is yielding to Jimmy Fallon. And Leno has stopped sniping at the NBC executives and officially acknowledged that he will step down sometime about a year from now and that Jimmy Fallon will take his place. And I don't really have a dog in this hunt. Because, as you may know, I watch The Daily Show, and if I'm still awake, I'll watch part of Stephen Colbert. And I realize not everybody's a political junkie. And they like to watch the movie stars come on and promote their bad flicks. But for me, the battle for late-night television ended a long time ago, and Comedy Central is the clear victor. Film critic Roger Ebert passed away at the age of 70.
Kids, if you want some fun, Mr. LaPage is your man. He's always laughing, having fun, showing his films in the den. Come on.
Roger Ebert was part of the film critic duo Siskel and Ebert. Televised movie preview show hosted by Siskel and Ebert with their famous thumbs up or thumbs down reviews was on for many years until Siskel died. And Roger Ebert, the last 10 years, had quite a health struggle. He had cancer starting in 2002. He had operations for thyroid cancer, salivary glands, his chin. He lost his ability to eat, drink, and speak. And he became a gaunter version of his once portly self. As a young talk show host in Chicago in the 1970s, I met Siskel and Ebert. They both had huge egos and weren't particularly nice to this kid. But I had a lot of respect for the work that each of them did. And I'm pleased to say a few nice words about Roger Ebert. I guess he's rejoined Gene Siskel at that big popcorn stand near the big screen in the sky. Well, thanks for joining me today for our news and comment podcast. Again, the interview with Richard Scrushy is available right now for you with or without a subscription. And hey, I got a spate of new subscriptions today. Haven't had a chance to see who they're from, but thank you very much. And if you haven't stepped up yet, I could really use your help. As I've mentioned, I've got a tax bill to pay and not enough scratch to give the government. So if you've been sitting on the sidelines, this is a great time for you to subscribe. All the details are right under my mug at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.